From South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Josh Heyer, and you're listening to the In the Moment Arts Podcast. Each week, In the Moment with Lori Walsh brings you news and arts coverage from across the state. You can listen live at 11 a.m. Central, 10 Mountain on SDPB Radio, or ask your smart speaker to play SDPB. And you can find every In the Moment segment at listen.sdpb.org or subscribe to our In the Moment Segments podcast. Now here's your weekly roundup in arts coverage.
So much has been interrupted or lost due to coronavirus, and so much expression and connection has swept online. And some of those offerings have quickly become more than anyone expected at first. The Social Distance Powwow Facebook group, as of this morning, is more than 140,000 people strong. Joining us with the story on In the Moment was Whitney Rencounter. Enjoy.
Whitney, welcome back.
Hello, good morning. How are you doing, Lori? Thanks for having me on this morning.
I am doing well, and you're still working and trying to figure out how to meet the needs of people in your community. Tell us a little bit about that for you.
Yes, so Rural America Initiatives, ATEAPI Youth Mentoring Program in Rapid City, South Dakota. We serve students 4th grade through 12th grade throughout the school district here. And currently with our Head Start, early Head Start programs as well, 0 to 5 year olds, overall we're sending food and supplies to over 400 families each week, during this tough time. And so we're very thankful and grateful. Our mentors are kind of volunteer essential workers just because of the population that we serve rely on our services so much that we didn't want to close down completely. We're trying our best to stay virtual and no contact drop off for the supplies as such, and keeping our staff safe during this time. But it's certainly challenging times for us.
Tell me a little bit about the Social Distance Powwow Facebook group and how that all got started.
Yeah, so myself and another one of the founders, we during the springtime and especially going into the summertime is when a lot of like colleges or other organizations have their huge powwow celebrations. And a powwow celebration is actually kind of, a place where people will gather to share songs and dances. And many of the participants, the singers and dancers, are, they're like professional at what they do. They practice all the time throughout the winter time and travel every weekend, sometimes 1,000 miles one way. And so it's become a huge part of the Native American indigenous way of life. And I think it's just, so important to our culture, and these songs and dances are so important to us. And matter of fact, some of the dances kind of sprung up around the time that the Spanish flu pandemic was hit our the world, and we couldn't understand why people were getting sick and why people were dying around that time. And so some of the dances, like the jingle dress, kind of came around that time from the Ojibwe tribe, and so many people dance that style nowadays. And so this was a response to what is happening in the world today. The Social Distance Powwow, group page on Facebook, and it's caught on like wildfire. So many people are so happy that it's there to provide an outlet and a way to kind of help us through our challenges and our problems today.
Tell me a little bit about for me, going through the Facebook page and seeing these people from different tribes everywhere. As a non-native, I've never seen so many expressions from different people in their living rooms, in different regalia. There are a lot of non-native folks who are tuning in and learning about things that are important for the first time because it wasn't part of their culture. It wasn't part of their hometown. Tell me a little bit about the reach for that and just the sort of, this side effect, this the thing that maybe you didn't plan to happen, is also helping people be seen in new ways.
Yeah, absolutely. So growing up here in South Dakota on a reservation myself, going to college. You know, when I went to college, at Black Hills State University here in Spearfish, South Dakota, I wanted to bring my family with me to the university because everyone there had an open mind and an open heart. And they understood that we had a powwow there on campus at the Donnelly Young Center every year. We sold Indian tacos. We fundraised for these events. And people were really excited and to learn and open. But in the bigger picture, most people are not really familiar because, you know, it's kind of human nature to stay with what you're comfortable with. And I think far too long, historically, the Cowboys and Indians theme has really created a division in our society. But when we break down those barriers and we think of things with an open mind and an open heart, we truly have a better appreciation for the songs and dances. And for the first time, everyone's at home. Everyone's open to see what's out there. And so with the click of a finger, you can watch a video from a dancer up in Canada or a dancer over in New York or a singer that lives in California or somebody that lives right here in South Dakota, you know, and you don't have to travel to the powwow or go to, a local powwow to experience that. I think far too long we think of things. A lot of times I talk to a lot of people and they say they aren't comfortable going to a powwow because they think of it like going to another church. And I think in reality, that's kind of human nature to kind of think of things as you don't understand what it is, so maybe I don't belong. But when we break down that barrier and realize powwows are a social event, and in actuality, they're actually closer to going to like a sporting event than it is a church, because the dancers are competing, the singers are competing, or they're getting paid for what they do just to kind of provide a place of fun and enjoyment, family celebration. So for the first time, people are having this access, and it is opening up their minds and their hearts, and they're saying, wow, why didn't I ever go to a powwow before? Or why didn't I get to experience these things? And this site is, Facebook could be such a place of hate and negativity. But for the first time, this site, because of the COVID-19, people are stuck at home, and so they're excited to have a site where they can go to, and it's 95% positive. All the comments, every message we've been getting from people all over the world have been positive feedback, that we have a place for people to come and view the songs and dances, the art, and it's a beautiful thing.
You mentioned dances, that are appropriate for this time, and talk a little bit about songs that are appropriate, for this time. And I'm hoping that I might entice you to sing for us, but, something that sort of says to, what are the choices that you make right now as far as what you share that could sustain people, that could give people a message that you think they need to hear right now?
Yeah. So I think, what is happening right now, obviously in our lifetime, we've never experienced anything like it. Other than the Spanish flu or the Black Plague in Europe long ago, these are things that just kind of come about that we have, we have no recollection of why. We don't understand. But nonetheless, our daily lives, our daily routines are all interrupted. We can't spend time and hug our friends and our families, all the things that we love and we miss. We have to take a step back. So I think these songs and these dances that are being shared on this page, many of them are done in a way to encourage people, to encourage people through challenges and to inspire people to live life simply. I just think so often and so much that we make things complicated. We make things complicated because of our race or because of our economic status or where we live, so on and so forth. But when we open our minds to understand that, there's good and bad in every culture and every community. And so when we think of things that way instead, we know who is, someone that is important to listen to, or someone who gets our attention, and what they say really hits home. It doesn't matter where they come from, their background. I just think Creator put good people in every corner of this world, every religion, every race, every culture. And so when we hear these songs and we see these dances, if you see some of the videos on this social distance power page, you see little kids out there dancing and their grandparents getting them ready. Or you see a song, or you see somebody talking about, you know, encouraging the first responders. I mean, a lot of indigenous first responders across North America are coming on this page and posting a picture of themselves before they're going to work, or, you know, and it's just, it gives us the ability to stay connected. So I think just understanding and learning about these songs and dances is an important time for this.
Hmm. Will you sing for us today and encourage us today?
Sure, I can, yeah. So, you know, myself, I grew up, my grandfather, the late Whitney Rencounter the First, he was a veteran of the Korean War. He was in the Army, but he also taught me how to sing and how to dance at powwows. It was a passion of his, and he used to make regalia. He used to provide and invite younger singers to come sing with us, and he encouraged others. If a dancer did not have the regalia to dance, he would make them regalia and give it to them. And those are things I always remember, his generosity and his compassion and willingness to help other people in need. And that's really hits home with me, you know, today. And so what I will share with you today is a kind of a round dance song, kind of an encouragement song to help us forget about what's going on today and to remember instead of the positive things that's going on today. And this song in our language, I learned this from the Porcupine Singers. I had a professor at Black Hills State University. Oddly enough, he's from Austria. But he lived here in South Dakota, and he was adopted into the Porcupine Singers drum group from the Oglala Sioux Tribe. And Dr. Ronnie Tice taught this song to me. But it talks about when we join hands with our friends, you know, we feel good, and it brings that happiness, brings that good feeling. And so that's what this song means in our language. But I'm going to sing it in our language. Me taco ye, me taco ye, na pe owe, weoske ya, wache anka cha ya la owe, ay owe, 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 me taco ye. Me taku ye na pe ahoe, we uske aya wa che aka cha hai ya la hoe, ay ohe ohe ohe. So that song is a round dance song, and usually everyone gets in a circle and joins hand in hand and dances around in a circle, especially when you make new friends and you have guests. That's when that song is brought out to celebrate, commemorate that occasion. So just thought I would share that to hopefully uplift our viewers today.
Oh, thank you so much, Whitney Rencounter. And another thing I just love about you is that you never say no when I ask you to do that. Yeah, you always say, okay, I will.
My grandfather, that's what he taught me, and a lot of the older singers, that's what they say. When you're called upon as a singer, always honor the request, you know, as best as you can. So,
All right. So Social Distancing Powwow or Social Distance Powwow Facebook group, before we let you go in our remaining 30 seconds, how do you want to encourage people who haven't participated to show up online and to be part of that sort of global encouragement right now?
Yeah, no, we go onto the page, and everyone has a different role. Sometimes you can look, you can just take a look and learn from people that are on there. But we encourage you to go on, and we promise you that it's a positive place, that it's a place of, I think it's important for this time because it's opening a lot of minds and hearts, and people from all over the world are reaching out to us wanting to tell the story of this social distance powwow page. And we're happy to share the message that essentially keeping it simple in this world, and we all need each other to survive. So thank you for having me on there, Lori, to share the story.
Thanks, Whitney. We'll see you next time. Be well.
You too. Stay healthy.
Like Pow Wow, the South Dakota Symphony Orchestra cultural events also got canceled. And this coronavirus has also put a halt drastically on many Lenten programs and services for Christians. So Maestro Delta David Geyer and Pastor Mark Bertrand of Grace Presbyterian Church wanted to be of service to listeners who might be missing music as art and music as worship over this Holy Week. They created a four-part series exploring musical masterpieces and the meaning behind them. Today we bring you episode 3, It Is Finished. Enjoy.
Welcome to Hearing the Music, a show where we explore musical masterpieces and the meaning behind them. This season, we're doing a deep dive on Johann Sebastian Bach's St. John Passion. My name is Mark Bertrand. I'm a novelist and a Christian minister, the pastor of Grace Presbyterian Church in Sioux Falls. I'm here to help unpack the ideas of the gospel narrative that Bach set to music. Across the table from me is Delta David Geyer, music director of the South Dakota Symphony Orchestra. David is our guide to this incredible music. In this episode, we'll also be hearing from musicologist Marcel Switzer. Thanks for joining us. This is episode 3. It is finished. The chorale that we've just been listening to comes immediately after an important moment in the story of the crucifixion, where Jesus, from the cross, has entrusted his mother Mary to the care of John, the evangelist, and said, "You know, woman, this is your son. Son, this is your mother." That example of Jesus' thoughtfulness, even in that moment of greatest suffering, inspires the words that we've just been hearing. In translation, the words are these: "He took good care of everything in the last hour, still thinking of his mother. He provided a guardian for her." And then there's a turn: "O mankind, do justice, love God and humanity, die without any sorrow, and do not be troubled." So even in this moment, we are encouraged to follow the example of Christ on the cross, to do good without regard to the consequences. Well, David, I think it's a really striking moment where the chorale is once again applying the lessons of the story to us in a way that encourages us to live in imitation of Christ. There's also something really important here, I think, about our relationship to suffering.
Indeed, that's really what strikes me, is when I think about when Bach would have written this, again, 300 years ago, that there was a lot more suffering in the world at that time. We in the Western world of the 21st century, we've distanced ourselves from suffering, isolated ourselves, put a little antiseptic on the suffering, particularly that of death, which would have been much more present in the congregation that would be hearing this in Leipzig in 1724, for whom death of family members, infant mortality, things like this would have been very present parts of life. So comfort, encouragement would have been on par with the sort of didacticness of a passion like this, and just simply the retelling of it, and also sort of hand in hand with the encouragement of their faith and to walk faithfully and to follow Christ. It's to identify with Christ in his suffering.
One of the differences in the way that this text treats suffering, in the way that, you know, generally we often think about how, let's say, religion deals with suffering, is that what's happening here is Jesus's example is not being offered as an antidote to suffering. It's correct. Not be like Jesus and you won't suffer.
Right.
The assumption is if you follow a suffering Savior, you can expect to suffer. The question is how you suffer and what that's like. And I think the comfort comes in the idea that Christ too has suffered.
Well, and there's a transformative power in suffering, which is kind of foreign to the way that we think about suffering. Suffering is something to be avoided and to be gotten through. And certainly there is that aspect. I mean, if you look at Christ's own ministry, you know, the vast majority of his time was spent in the alleviation of suffering. But the value of suffering for us as individuals, the transformative power of looking to Christ, looking to God, looking for meaning in the midst of suffering. And what better example of meaning in the midst of suffering is there than Christ's redemptive work on the cross?
That's right. There's a passage in the Epistle to the Hebrews that speaks of Christ as a high priest and says that because of his humanity, because of his experience of what it means like to be one of us, we have a high priest who can relate to us in our suffering. And I think that is a point that this chorale really brings out very well.
And it sets up the sort of central portion that we're going to discuss today of the Passion. It's in the center of the second part, but it's really, really the central meaning of the entire Passion. And the way that Bach said it is so meaningful and brings it to not just to life, but personalizes it.
It really does. I think that also leads to a question that we should think about before we dive into the center, which has to do with Bach's own belief about these things. I mean, we look, it's certainly possible for a musician to take a great text and set it to music beautifully, but not to believe in the text that he's setting to music. That happens all of the time.
Sure.
Do you have any thoughts about Bach's own, kind of where he was in relation to this faith?
What I get is from the music itself and how the care that he took with it. I mean, you can look at it as merely inventive. We've looked at that in the first two episodes of this, is the sort of ingenuity that he uses to bring the text to life. And when I was in little conductor school, you know, going to conservatory, the way that our professors would talk about Bach usually was along those lines, that he was a church musician. So of course he took the text and he was really inventive with it. But there's a deeper layer here of meaning for those of us who have spent our life steeped in this repertoire, that it affects us quite deeply, and I think it comes from a sincerity on Bach's part. There are some indications, such as the relatively recent discovery of Bach's own Bible and the notations that he made in the margins of that Bible, and there's been, you know, a high level of scholarship around this.
In the 1930s, this Bible was rediscovered and had kind of gone under the radar, and so this is a Bible commentary that Bach possessed in multiple volumes. It was a work put together by a theologian, Kalloff, so they refer to it as the Kalloff Bible. And so it included the text of Scripture and also commentary on that, and is full of underlining and occasionally marginal notes that Bach made himself. And we actually were fortunate enough to speak to a Bach scholar about this, someone who has worked on this Bible and has some interesting observations on this.
Yes, my friend Marcel Switzer is a musicologist in the Netherlands, and Marcel and I have worked together in Hungary at the Crescendo Summer Institute for many years now. And as a matter of fact, he's at work right now on a book about Bach and the Holy Spirit.
So we asked him for some insight, and Marcel was kind enough to share some thoughts.
In the study Bible, we first of all find out that Bach was someone who studied the Bible very carefully and must have put quite an amount of time in it. And there we find some underlinings of passages in the Bible from which we actually can conclude that he was indeed theologically very well informed, and it meant a lot to him personally as well.
So we have some insight into Bach's faith in general, but one of the questions we were curious about was whether Bach had made choices in the St. John Passion that might give us some insight. So we asked Marcel about this, and he had some interesting observations.
But in Bach's time, it became more custom to treat the gospel text actually as a kind of opera, and it was a fashion in his time to stay away from the literal biblical text and to use libretti that emphasized Christ's suffering, and particularly the physical suffering. What is particularly interesting in the St. John Passion is that Bach, at the one hand, takes his famous verses by Brockes over, but there has been some editor at work who actually made the text less violent, and Bach made the choice to take the gospel account from John as the main part of the text. And in that sense, he is, I would not say old-fashioned, but at least traditional. And so the fascinating aspect of the piece is that it is a mixture of respect and awe for the traditional gospel text, and it is contemporary in that sense that it uses these verses by Brockes, but then at the same time, it reduces the amount of physical, violent details in favor of a deeper spiritual content.
Thank you, Marcel, for that. We are reaching the heart of the St. John Passion now, Movement 30, which is an aria titled Es ist vollbracht, it is finished. This is a moment immediately prior to the death of Jesus, where he declares these words, it is finished. The music here is stunning. It's very different in some ways. The text is really important, though. As we approach this aria, we're actually going to do this in a little bit of depth, because that's how important this is. So we're going to look at the first part and then the second part. In the first part of the aria, the text in translation reads, "It is finished, O comfort for the ailing soul. The night of sorrow now measures out its last hour." That text, with all of the emotion to it, is rivaled completely by the music, which is absolutely evocative of these emotions, David, and quite unique for the piece, isn't it?
Indeed. So Bach really pares down his forces for the effect is of focusing on this text. So you have a viola da gamba, you have a lute, and you have an alto voice. And so it's quiet, it's soft, it's slow. The tempo marking is molto adagio, which varies slowly. Just again, sort of laying emphasis on the importance of this text. Pathos is a word that comes firmly to my mind for this aria. We're drawn into this moment, not just the sufferings of Christ, but the completion of his mission, his life's mission at this moment. It's my favorite moment in all of Bach, this aria, for both the A and the B sections of it. So let's take it apart a little bit with the A section, with this text, Es ist vollbracht, first. You'll notice that the lines, the vocal lines, they descend, as you might expect, like a bowing of the head, an expiration, with the exception of one word, Trost, which is consolation, right? Es ist vollbracht, O Trost. It is finished. O consolation for afflicted souls. And every time the soloist sings the word Trost, it goes up, which is almost sometimes leaping in terms of its expression, the vocal line. to this moment of, you know, this is something we look towards for our comfort. And now, out of the blue, like a bolt of lightning, we have this text, Der Held aus Juda siegt mit Macht. The hero from Judah triumphs with might. Where does this come from? This totally contrasting music, which brings us into another place, and why does it belong here?
Der Held aus Juda siegt mit Macht. Der Held aus Juda siegt mit Macht.
that music comes straight out of the world of opera, which Bach borrowed from copiously. In the world of opera, this would have been called a battle aria, a rage aria. You would expect to find it in Handel's Julius Caesar or something like that. And again, the text is that the hero of Judah triumphs in might and closes the battle. I think this speaks of a really deep theological principle here, that when you pair these two texts and these two contrasting musics and how they fit together, that we have, it is finished, but yet a triumph. It reminds me, Mark, of the theological principle that Christ taught throughout his ministry, that the first will be last and the last will be first, that in death we find resurrection. I mean, the reverberations throughout, you know, centuries of religious teaching are right here in this aria.
Yeah, we talk about in theology the contrast between humiliation and exaltation. And honestly, those words do not do justice to the reality behind them. This music, I think, goes a farther way to doing justice to it. What Bach has done here in combining those two emotional moods in giving you sorrow, and then in the midst of sorrow, this sudden outburst and expression of joy, is a really fine way of expressing the different facets of meaning behind the crucifixion. There's a mystery, looking from the outside in, why people would celebrate the death of Christ, why that death would be an occasion for joy, why it might be seen as a triumph and not only as a tragedy. And I think that this aria captures both sides of it. A tragedy, certainly, in the sense that there is a suffering that takes place, a death that Christ dies. But in that death, Christ gains a victory. And the question that you have to ask yourself is, what is the meaning of the words, "it is finished"? You know, what does Christ mean when he says it is finished? And I would say this is a question many people think they know the answer to, but really don't. When you hear those words, "it is finished," you're likely to think, oh, he means his life is finished. He's about to die. And so these are words he speaks just meaning kind of like, well, I'm about to go. It's done. My life here is over, something like that. But in fact, what is finished at the cross is the work of salvation. Jesus is finishing the thing he came to earth to do. And that's where the note of triumph comes in. Because what he's come here to do is to win a great victory over death and sin. It's a victory. You can actually go back to the very beginning of the Bible and discover the roots of. If you go back to the book of Genesis, in Genesis 3:15, a passage that is often referred to by theologians as the proto-evangelion, it's the first hint of the gospel. This is the scene where Adam and Eve have fallen, and God comes down and administers justice. He gives them a sentence. He speaks to the man, he speaks to the woman, but before he does that, he speaks to the serpent. And in Genesis 3:15, he tells the serpent that one day the seed or offspring of the woman will bruise the head of your seed. And from that moment forward, there's a conflict between the seed of the woman, the offspring of the woman, and the offspring of Satan. That question, who will be triumphant? That's a question, if you know your Old Testament, that is played out in the drama of the kings of Israel, the anointed ones of Israel, and then Christ is the inheritor of that conflict and comes as the great hero to win, to bring about the victory.
It reminds me of another passion representation that our listening audience might be more familiar with, and that is Mel Gibson's Passion of the Christ. Controversial film, but the opening scene has Christ in the Garden of Gethsemane praying and that the cup would pass from him, and He ends by saying, "Nevertheless, your will, not mine, be done." And as he while he's praying, there's the serpent is in the garden, snaking around.
Mm-hmm.
And when Christ gets up to walk out of the garden, he crushes the serpent with his heel as right. he walks out of the garden. So this is kind of a little similar in this aria, because this text of the hero of Judah triumphing in might, it's not scriptural,
mm-hmm.
right? It's brought in. And this goes in this very long line of passion representations, which are just not simply an explication of the text, but rather an artistic representation, which brings in these other ideas and pairs them in order to illuminate, humanize the gospel even a little bit more, perhaps. So in my mind, you know, Mel Gibson was extending that with his film, right. successfully or not, but at least that scene, I think, is it's a parallel to what we're looking at here.
Right, and I think he's trying to address the challenge, which is giving a context to the crucifixion that takes into account the thousands of years of history that go before it and are necessary in order to understand the significance of those words, "It is finished," to know what is finished in that moment.
It also speaks of Christmas, does it not? that the salvation project of
yes.
of God becoming human. We think of Christmas as a nice tale or mm-hmm. something warm and fuzzy, but when the prophet says he'll be called Emmanuel, which means God with us, that would be, you know, the incarnation.
Right.
And the purpose of the incarnation was to bring salvation to the entire world.
And there's a really good thread when it comes to thinking about the atonement, Jesus' death on the cross, that addresses that, where we think about the necessity of Christ's humanity. So Anselm famously asked this question in a book of his circa 1000 AD, why the God-man? Why was the incarnation necessary?
Right.
And the answer that he comes up with is that it was necessary for Christ to be fully human and fully divine in order to make the atonement for sin that was necessary. And we won't go down the rabbit hole of tracing all of the logic there, but that was a thread in the death of Christ that really emphasizes the need for it, what it is that he came to do in terms of atoning for sin, paying the price for sin. Bach, following the lead of John's gospel, is really highlighting for us another thread. We get that sense of the atoning sacrifice, but we also get this really strong sense of the triumphant king, right? And throughout our discussion, this question of kingship has been at the forefront. Is Jesus a king? If so, what kind of kingdom is he king over? That sort of thing. Now we see the kind of king he is, a king who triumphs over death, which is the enemy of his people. And he triumphs over death in his own death, which is a 17th century theologian, John Owen, who wrote a book about the atonement, the title of which is The Death of Death in the Death of Christ.
Mm.
And I think the title alone encapsulates that sense of triumph, that the hero of Judah has triumphed over what? Over death.
I'm Mark Bertrand. I'm here with Delta David Geyer, and this is Hearing the Music, a show where we explore musical masterpieces and the meaning behind them. David is the music director of the South Dakota Symphony Orchestra, and I'm a novelist and the pastor of Grace Presbyterian Church in Sioux Falls. Together, we've been working our way through the St. John Passion, Bach's Good Friday masterpiece. This is Episode 4, Dissolve My Heart. So So I have to begin this episode with an apology to David, because I have split two arias that really go together. In the last episode, we spent a lot of time unpacking Es ist vollbracht, the aria related to Christ's words, "It is finished." But the one that follows almost immediately afterward asks a lot of questions that are prompted by that statement. And so in David's mind, they really go together. So David, my apologies, and also explain to us why it is that these two pieces really live side by side.
Well, you did wound me, Mark.
I apologize. It's not the first time or the last time.
Yeah, they do go hand in hand to me. Es ist vollbracht, it is finished, is such a wonderfully contemplative meditation that brings us into the pathos of the moment of Christ's death. Mein teurer Heiland, lass dich fragen, my precious Savior, let me ask you, is the answer to that. Having come through the suffering, we come to this point of what's our response, personally and collectively? And we get both the personal and the collective in a very surprisingly inventive way in this particular aria. But in the course of this, the soloist actually, he says, let me ask you, and he has three very important questions.
Yeah, I mean, I love the placement of this. So the evangelist will set this up with a brief statement. He bowed his head and departed. So Christ has died. And then immediately after his death, we get this aria saying, my precious Savior, let me ask you these questions about the significance of your death. And you get three questions. The first is, am I made free from death because of your death? The second is, can I, through your pain and death, inherit the kingdom of heaven? And then the third is, has the redemption of the whole world arrived? As you listen, you can hear kind of the emphasis in the first question. It's freedom from death. So have I been rescued from the consequences of sin? And the second question, it's can I now inherit the kingdom of heaven? So where there's a freedom from sin in the first part, in the second part, it's like a freedom to inherit, to be what I was created to be. And the third question really sums up all of it. Does this now mean that the redemption of the world has arrived? Have you done the work of redemption now? Those are the questions that are being asked of Christ in this moment.
Yes, as you're reading the questions for the first time, it's really occurring to me that this is further answered by the final chorus, where he talks about, we'll get to in a moment, but it talks about that the gates of hell being closed and the gates of heaven being opened through this redemptive act on the cross.
There's something that happens here musically too that's worth mentioning, where like something takes place here that hasn't happened in the whole piece. We've been talking about chorales, we've been talking about arias and their various functions, but here we get an aria and a chorale at the same time.
That's right. They're interspersed. So the question, sometimes the question is happening simultaneously, sometimes the question's asked in between verses of a chorale, the text of which is, Jesus, you who were dead, live now unendingly. In the last pangs of death, I will turn nowhere else but to you who has absolved me, O beloved Lord. Only give me what you earned. More do I not desire. So as the questions are being asked, it's being answered by the chorus. Again, the tune, the chorale tune, the words would have been known to the congregation.
So what should we listen for in this music?
Well, we talked about the last aria, "It is finished," as being intimate. This is also intimate in a different way. We have a solo cello here, played by our former principal cello, Maxim Kozlov, and it's in dialogue with the soloist. The melody that is played is lilting. It's gently dancing. It's like we've been freed. It's tender, but not sentimental. We tend to attach a lot of our own sentiment to religious feeling, but I don't think that Bach ever erred into the sentimental. The other thing I would point out is that the soloist here, Stephen Condy, is a sympathetic soloist. So we've done a lot of sacred music here at the SDSO, and it's interesting when people have a sympathy towards the text and when they don't. Sometimes it's a genuine, you know, religious connection to the text. Sometimes it's just a knowledge of it and what needs to be communicated. Sometimes I find myself working with soloists for Messiah or something like that, where I actually have to really explain, you know, theologically here, what's happening, what the composer intends for you to communicate, how to communicate it to the audience. In Stephen's case, none of that applied because he sings it with a full knowledge and a deep internalization of these questions. You can hear it in his voice.
Thank you. lässt du das Haupt und sprichst stillschweigend ja.
Simply beautiful. The soloist at the end acknowledges that Jesus is bowing his head and saying silently, yes. Yes to all three of the questions. Am I made free from death? Yes. Can I, through your pain and death, inherit the kingdom of heaven? Yes. And has the redemption of the whole world arrived? Yes.
So now we reach the second part of the St. John Passion, where Bach reaches into Matthew's gospel in order to supplement the story. Here he quotes Matthew 27, verses 51 and 52, to provide these details that, behold, the temple curtain was torn in two pieces from top to bottom. The earth shook and the cliffs were rent and the graves opened up and many bodies of the saints arose. So he gives us that scene, and then what follows is a reaction to that experience. So we get a brief arioso, which is an immediate reaction, and it also sets up questions, a big question that arguably the rest of the St. John Passion is designed to answer in various ways.
Right, so you'll hear tenor Heath Huberg here in this little arioso. It means a small aria. These events taken from Matthew, the earthquake, and so on, are encapsulated by him speaking to himself. The first two words you'll hear are, my heart. And at the end of it, what will you, for your part, do? What is your response? My heart, speaking to himself. How should we respond? And we'll see how that plays out for the rest of the Passion. Tenor has just set up the question for us, what for your part will you do in response, in light of all of the things that have just transpired? We have two answers, one for solo soprano and the other for chorus. The first one is very personal. The text of it is, dissolve my heart in floods of tears. Here sung by soprano Hannah Celeste Liu, accompanied by one flute, one English horn, and the organ and cello. It's a very intimate aria. She sings this first part, dissolve my heart. And then you'll notice with the text, tell the world in heaven the anguish, your Jesus is dead. That at that moment, the accompaniment also dissolves and leaves the soprano in a kind of desolate spot, just proclaiming, your Jesus is dead.
Thank you.
in that gorgeous singing and playing, there were a couple of Baroque conventions that you may have noticed. One is these very short notes that you heard in both the accompaniment and the soprano, which are tears falling, and also this sighing motif, the dee-da, dee-da, da-da. This, you know, for us still today, we hear that and we feel this sort of mourning quality to it. So that was obviously recognizable to Bach's congregation at the time, as it is for us today. Now we go to the second answer, which is a chorus, the penultimate piece in the St. John Passion. So if this aria's answer was our personal response of mourning at the death of Christ, Mark, perhaps now we're looking for the meaning.
Yeah, I think there is a distance between the two responses. The first one has the sense of immediacy of the trauma of death that is accompanied by mourning. But in the second answer, in the chorus, there's actually a prayer to Christ to rest well and to bring me peace. And it actually says, now I will no longer mourn you. So the period of mourning is over, and now there's a sense of hopeful anticipation, a kind of looking forward to what will come as we stand by the graveside of Christ.
Yeah, it's worth noting that the intervening recitative between these two answers does talk about Christ's burial, Joseph of Arimathea taking the body and preparing it, and all of that story, the background of this passage. So this response then to our witnessing of Christ's burial.
Yeah, I think there's a good way of thinking about it in the text itself, which reads in translation, the grave that is allotted to you and encloses no further suffering opens heaven for me and closes off hell. So at this moment, the suffering of Christ has come to an end. As his body is committed to the grave, the chorus sings, rest well. His suffering is at an end. What's left is to anticipate the glory of the opening of heaven to his people as a result of what he has endured.
The final chorale of the St. John Passion is an expression of hope, an expression of faith. It ties into the lullaby nature of the previous chorus. The text is, Ah, Lord, let your dear little angel at my final end take my soul to Abraham's bosom. Let my body in its little sleeping chamber, absolutely softly without any anguish or pain, rest until the last day. But then it goes on to express quite a triumphant hope, Mark.
Yes, the text says, at that day, wake me from death so that my eyes may see you in all joy, O Son of God. And there you have, in a nutshell, the hope of the gospel. There's a similarity, a likeness to Jesus in his death. But that likeness is predicated on a hope that we will also be raised from the dead as Jesus was. And so it makes perfect sense at the end of the St. John Passion, as
We reflect on everything that has happened up to this moment, and we think about Christ on Good Friday leaving him, as it were, in the tomb. We think of our own death. We are reminded of our own mortality, and then the prayer becomes that I, in my death, might commend myself to God in the hope of the resurrection, which, of course, on Good Friday has not yet been celebrated. That waits till Easter. But there's still the anticipation, the hope that you can hear brimming in these words and in this music. Thank you for listening to Hearing the Music. Throughout the show, you've heard excerpts from the SDSO's 2014 performance of the St. John Passion. You can hear the entire performance online, listen to bonus episodes, and check out our reading list and more by visiting hearingthemusic.org.
That's the show for this week. Thank you for joining us. If you have a story idea, send an email to inthemoment@sdpb.org. For Lori Walsh, Chris Loffrey, I'm Josh Heyer. Thank you for listening.